Thanks a lot, Devin. It's great to be with you. And I've got a number of things here I want to make sure I don't lose track of. And it's great to see a number of folks I've met before, and hopefully we'll get a chance to connect here in the next day or so. Let's pray. Father, I pray that the words of my mouth and the meditations of my heart will be acceptable to you, for you are our rock and our redeemer. Amen. My remarks this evening are not a biblical exposition. They're more like what you see referred to in 1 Chronicles chapter 12 with the men of Issachar. You know, we're told that they understood the times and knew what to do. I've been trying hard to understand the times, and I think when you have a sense of what the times hold, you have some sense of what to do. So I'd like to reflect on the subject of my talk, which is resilience in a blue state. You know, sometimes when you're given an invitation to speak somewhere, they say, hey, what do you want to talk about? Just go ahead and tell us. Other times they say, this is the title. You will speak on that. And I said, this is the thing I'm supposed to talk about, so I'm going to do that. So, and I'm glad to. Certainly a worthy subject to address, resilience in a blue state. Give a little bit of background to me. I'm pretty familiar with blue states. My entire ministry has been in blue states. We didn't used to call them blue states. We just called them, well, actually, you know, once upon a time, red stood for communism. You know, and I don't know when it happened, but there was a flip that occurred somewhere in the past, and I still don't get it, but anyway, so, you know, I lived in Cambridge. My wife is here with me tonight. We lived right between Harvard and MIT for years. It's pretty blue there, and we found ourselves in this environment. It caused me no end of trouble in terms of thinking about how to live and minister in that environment. I had read a lot of philosophy, did a lot of work in philosophy in my undergraduate and graduate degrees, and ended up actually at Harvard Divinity School for a period of time and working in ethics. So I also knew world-class blue theologians, guys that actually, you know, when people ask me what's the difference between like the East Coast liberalism and the West Coast liberalism, it may not be the case today, but at one time, the way you could describe it is this: West Coast liberalism is always trying to prove something, and East Coast liberalism doesn't feel like it has anything it needs to prove. That's kind of the big difference. You know, you get a lot of goofy stuff over here. Back east, they don't actually let people sleep in the street and stuff like that. But anyway, so that's the framework within which I've done a lot of my reflecting on the subject. Now, red state, blue state, one fish, two fish, you know, red fish, blue fish, you know. States are not uniformly red or blue. I don't know if you noticed that. Oregon has some pretty large territory that it has and wishes, and the people who live there wish they weren't in Oregon anymore. They're trying to join Idaho. And this is true everywhere. I think maybe a good way to think about it is blue cities and red countrysides. That seems to be the way it works, because you go to red states and you'll find blue cities, right? You go to Austin in Texas. You know the statement, keep Portland weird? You know where they got it? Austin. It was keep Austin weird. And by the way, Portland and Austin are cities, sister cities. I don't know if you knew that, but it's a really inexpensive flight from Portland to Austin and back. It's like, I'm not exaggerating, it could be half the price of going to Dallas. You know, they've got some kind of deal sharing their weirdness. I don't know what it is. And, you know, when you think about that place that everybody wants to go to, Moscow or Moscow, I'm told you're not supposed to say cow, Moscow. It's pretty blue. I saw a whole lot more tension and confrontation there than I remember during my days in Cambridge. So you're not going to get away from it, you know, so just get over it. I guess that's one of the things to think about. Now, when we think about red and blue, sometimes, especially now, we think about the political parties, right? I mean, the red Republicans, I still have a hard time making that work in my mind, and blue Democrats. But at least historically, they weren't uniformly red and blue. There were actually blue dog Democrats once upon a time who were kind of red. But you have to be really old to remember that. There were the Reagan Democrats. I don't know if you remember those folks during the Reagan years. Reagan did this really cool thing. We also lived in Boston, not far from the center of the Democratic machine, the Erie Pub in Dorchester. Dorchester is like Boston's Brooklyn. And we were just a short walk away from it. And I told my wife, hey, we got to go over there sometime because that's the location where Ronald Reagan made his surprise appearance, right at the heart of the Democratic machine in Boston when he was running for office. I think it was in 84. That might not be quite right. But anyway, he shows up, and it turned out that the head of his security detail was from Boston, grew up Irish Catholic guy, so definitely knew the scene. If you've ever seen The Departed, that film, that is the old Boston, the Irish Mafia. But anyway, all kinds of fun stuff about it. We also lived in Winter Hill, where the Winter Hill gang was. But Reagan just showed up out of the blue. There was suddenly this presidential entourage just pulls into the, you know, right in front of the Erie Pub, and the doors open up, and there's Reagan, and the place just stands and cheers. I don't think that would happen today, but it happened once upon a time. And then there were the well Republicans, the liberal Republicans, the Rockefeller Republicans. I don't know if you remember those guys, but those guys were about as left wing on social issues as you can imagine. So things have gotten kind of polarized, and we have some concentrations in either party now, but in both the parties, there's still a lot of unrest, and there are disagreements, and there are groups within those parties that have a hard time getting along with each other. So let's not imagine that it's just this homogenous Velveeta cheese kind of thing in either place. Parties and the trends, particularly since 64 for the Republicans and since 68 for the Democrats, have been at the sort of the source, or these are the two sources for the polarization. Remember 64 with Barry Goldwater? That was a horrible defeat that he experienced, but it was the beginning of the Reagan Revolution. That's Reagan was sort of the guy who received the torch and led the party after that. And then in 68, that's when the big riots occurred, you know, in Paris and in Chicago, and the new left took over the Democratic National Convention. But this is ancient history, I know, but this is the kind of the background for some of this stuff. Now, another thing about ruling ideologies in these different places is you can be surprised. Sometimes it's easier to homeschool in a blue state. I know that's a shocking bit of news, but when we lived in Connecticut, they were perfectly fine with us not being in the public school. And they never checked in on us. But I know people in Georgia and Alabama say you get all kinds of mess when you try to do homeschool because you're supposed to support the hometown team. You know, there's just a whole kind of different ethos. So, again, you might find yourself surprised. Now, I think, though, in blue states, it's undeniable that there are certain institutions where people feel the pressure. And those institutions tend to be large corporations, nonprofit and government organizations, and public institutions that are dedicated to education, like universities and public schools. Those are the places where you feel the pressure. When you're not in those places, you don't necessarily feel as much pressure. If you work for yourself, or you homeschool, or you have, you know, in your own means of livelihood, then you're not going to feel it as much. So when I think about red states and blue states, I thought it was important to make certain we define the terms. What we're really getting at is a ruling ideology. So in a place like Tennessee or a place like Texas, the ruling ideology has got a red character. And in a place like Oregon or Washington or California, the ruling ideology has got a blue cast or character. So resilience, let's think a little bit about that. For something to be resilient, it's got to be alive. So what we're thinking of is some kind of organism, some kind of living thing that can survive in an adverse environment, that's got the ability to deal with adversity. Now, sometimes creatures are made to thrive in hostile environments. I think about rattlesnakes and eels. You know, rattlesnakes do really well in places where human beings tend to not do so well. And same thing with eels. So they're designed for hostile environments, and Christianity is designed to be not only resilient, but to thrive in a hostile environment. Just look at the history of the church. The blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church, right? Tertullian. We can say the good old days were the bad old days, again and again and again and again. So, something worth remembering. Now, I'd like to reflect a bit on liberal ideology and what makes a blue state inhospitable. Liberal ideology and what makes a blue state inhospitable. So, I want to think about the origins of liberalism with you a little bit. It's a hydra-headed thing. You remember the hydra, several heads, cut off one, two sprout where there was once one, you know, that kind of thing. Liberalism is a bit like that, so I'm going to oversimplify for the sake of brevity and hopefully understanding. First of all, I'd like to talk about ideologies. What are they? I think we use them, I think we use the term more loosely than we should. An ideology is not a philosophy. Now, it is the outworking of a particular kind of philosophy, modern philosophy. But it's not what historically philosophers considered philosophy. And it's certainly not revelation. Now, if you look at the word ideology, you can isolate a root, ideas, right? Ideas. Now, when we think about these ideas, how do they correspond with or relate to reality? That's an important thing to keep in mind. Ideologies don't really care about reality. Ideologies impose a structure on reality. That's an important thing to keep in mind. So when we think about this, when we talk about an ideology, what matters is its internal consistency, not whether or not it corresponds to the reality that we all live in. So an older view is the correspondence theory of reason, which is there's a reality out there and my ideas need to reflect that reality. And if my ideas reflect that reality, I can use words to describe that reality and I can thrive in an environment in which I find myself situated. Okay? Ideologies don't work that way. Ideologies are more interested in sort of the internal consistency of the ideas and who really cares about reality, because it's not believed by ideologues, modern thinkers, that reality actually says anything. It's just mute. It's stupid. It's stuff. It doesn't reflect the wisdom of God, for example. It's just there. Now, the older view is that it actually does speak and it can teach. So, you know, we can go to the 19th Psalm to see an example of that. And there we see in that psalm, let me turn to that. This said or stated, the heavens declare, they speak, declare the glory of God, and the sky above proclaims his handiwork. Day to day pours out speech, and night to night reveals knowledge. There is no speech, nor are there words. The voice is not heard, yet the voice goes out throughout all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. Creation speaks. I paraphrase that a little bit to get my point made. Now, the fact that the world is founded on wisdom means that the wise conform to the wisdom found in the nature of things. Right? Now, a wonderful book that's addressing the crisis of our moment was this book, The Abolition of Man by C.S. Lewis, which I think was published back in, 1944. So if you think this is all new, I've got news for you. This goes way back. The challenges that we're facing go way back. And in this book, there's this marvelous statement. Perhaps you've heard it before, but this is where Lewis is zeroing in on this matter that I just described. He says, "For the wise men of old, the cardinal problem had been how to conform the soul to reality. And the solution had been knowledge, self-discipline, and virtue. For magic and applied science alike, the problem is how to subdue reality to the wishes of men. And the solution is technique." The word technique has a root, techne. It's also the root of our word technology. So when we employ techniques to get people to do what we want them to do, it's the same spirit that causes us to make machines to do things that we want them to do. The same kind of thinking is in play. And the goal is to subdue nature, to make it do what we want it to do. It doesn't teach us. We teach it to do as we please. Now, at the beginning of the modern era, there was a revolution in thought when it came to political philosophy. And this revolution in thought was conducted through a series of thought experiments by early modern philosophers. And what these philosophers all sought to picture for their readers and for themselves is the individual in the state of nature, stripped of culture and social support. And in this state of nature, it was imagined that individuals were all free and equal. And society, it was believed, or at least assumed, wasn't natural. Everything that we create socially is artificial and consequently not the fruit of nature. This actually contradicts something that Aristotle taught. Aristotle said that human beings are social animals. He didn't mean animal in the way, maybe in a derogatory sense, but he just meant it just as a reality. We are embodied creatures. We live with each other. Tarzan didn't exist. We're born into families. We're born into social groups. But these theorists, let me give you three, I'm sure heard of them, Thomas Hobbes, John Locke, and Jean-Jacques Rousseau. These are the progenitors of social contract theory. And what they propose is that individuals prescind the natural order that they find themselves born into and can then choose to enter into a social contract or not. And I know that practically speaking, that's not really workable, but at least as a thought experiment, this is something that's important for us to do, because the goal is to figure out ways that we can construct a social environment in which freedom and equality are just, you know, supported and promoted. Let me give you an example or a set of explanations for how things worked according to each of these philosophers. So Thomas Hobbes is kind of the pessimist. He's famous for having said, life in the state of nature is poor, solitary, brutish, and short. In other words, it's something that we should try to avoid. And we enter into a social contract with the king or the authority, which can, through force of arms, create an order in which our lives are secure. That's basically the idea. So we give over something of our ourselves and our freedom to the state, and the state makes sure that no one sneaks into our house in the middle of the night and slits our throat. That's the job of the state. John Locke had a more optimistic view of things. John Locke is famous for having said that we have natural rights. These natural rights come from God. Hobbes, in case you hadn't guessed, was an atheist. He wouldn't have owned up to that in his time because that could have gotten his throat slit. But he really was. If you read Leviathan and you examine the assumptions that underlie it, you realize this guy doesn't believe in the order that's described in the 19th Psalm. He doesn't really believe that the heavens declare the glory of God. He just thinks that it's just, you know, nature is red in tooth and claw. That's what he believed. Now, as I noted, Locke, who was a child of the Puritans, he had a more optimistic view, which is an odd thing to say for Puritans if you're, you know, kind of associate them with, you know, total depravity. But he maintained that we have natural rights that come from God, and those rights have to do with life, liberty, and not the pursuit of happiness. That's a Thomas Jefferson gloss. Man, our whole country would be a whole lot different if he just stuck with the program. It was property. Life, liberty, and property. And the job of the government is not just simply to keep you alive, but to secure those other rights, to keep people from harming you, taking your property. You get the drift. Now, the hippie of the bunch was Rousseau. He was that freaky guy. He's known as the other man from Geneva. He was from Geneva. He knew all about John Calvin. He just disagreed with Calvin about everything. And according to Rousseau, we are naturally good. And what corrupts us are our social institutions. That's the source of the trouble, our social institutions. And what we ought to do is sort of kind of get out of the way. Now, this led to a weird set of maybe counterintuitive outcomes in his philosophy. One of those counterintuitive outcomes is that the fact that the state is not just simply something that's supposed to get out of the way. It's supposed to make it possible for us all to kind of be ourselves, which means in his case, because he didn't think of himself as a father, the state was supposed to raise, I think it was the 5 children that he sired. And so he was a terrible father. He just kind of had kids and expected other people to take care of them because that was the job of the state. But that's kind of the quick summary of those different thinkers and outlooks. Now, what this all meant in each case and up into our present day is that authority must be justified to the individual. The state has to justify itself. The church has to justify itself. The family has to justify itself. Everything must justify itself to you. There are no givens. There are no duties. It's just simply freedom and equality. This is what we're supposed to enjoy. There's a problem, though. And this is a tension that many people have noted when it comes to those two values, freedom and equality. And it's this: the more freedom, the less equality. The more equality, the less freedom. they don't actually get along very well. And kind of the history of our country is this sort of drunken walk, kind of leaning one direction and then the other at different points in our history. And the equality side of things has gotten pretty weird recently. And the reason for that is the rise of the new left. And something that I came across here the other day that is referred to as normophobia. Mary Harrington in First Things came up with that term, and I think it's great. So getting back to the 1968 and the rise of the new left, something to think about. Do you remember the hard hats and hippie riots in the late 60s? You have to be my age to be able to remember that, guys. My father taught at Washington U in St. Louis, so I lived in kind of the bohemian, seething cauldron of this kind of stuff. I remember people running down the street naked. It was called streaking. And they did it in large numbers because it made it harder to arrest them when they did it that way. But anyway, it was a wild time. If you think that it's bad now, it was bad then too. And the people who were rioting and fighting each other were both on the left. It was the old economic left versus the new culturally Marxist left, the hippies and the hard hats. The hard hats were socially conservative. They actually worked for a living, and they used their hands to make stuff. And they cared about families, and they cared about their neighborhoods, and they cared about their little, not so little sometimes, Catholic parishes in places like Boston and Philadelphia and New York. And they were a huge force in the Democratic Party. They had they made up an important voting bloc that had to be placated and served. They went into decline in the 70s and the 80s, and now are just a shadow of what they once were. But that transition from the old left to the new left began, or at least became a public thing in 1968. And the two places where it made its presence really felt, this is sort of like, the Black Lives Matter riots and that kind of stuff. By the way, when I was a kid, it seemed like every time you turned on the television, a politician had been assassinated. It was a pretty raw time. You know, the time we're living in, I don't want to make light of it, but it's not the worst that we've experienced. There was a lot of bad stuff in the past. But during that time, a saying was coined and it became graffiti. I'm sure it was all over Portland. And it was this: it is forbidden to forbid. Now, that doesn't actually make much sense. There's an inner logical inconsistency, a self-refuting character to that statement. But anyway, it is forbidden to forbid. And the reason that that was thought to be the case was what I was talking to you about earlier, about the triumph of equality and freedom, and the belief that there were no norms that we could derive from nature, that the natural order was mute. And the reason why the natural order is mute, or was mute, is guess why? Because it wasn't made. It's just an accident of nature. There's no intelligence at work in it, ordering it at all. It's just the kind of spontaneously generated order. And so that's why people didn't look to nature to learn wisdom, because wisdom didn't order things at all. Wisdom is something that we brought to nature, because nature lacks intrinsic meaning. And it also means, and this is what we're experiencing really strongly at the moment, is language doesn't speak. Not only doesn't nature speak, neither do we really speak to each other. All we do, according to the best lights of postmodernism, is project our desires and agenda on other people. And that's why we play these language games. you're not going to call me anything that I don't want to be called. I'm going to make it all up out of nothing for myself. Because the alternative is to be subject to your agenda, because we're not really communicating anything objective in character at all. Nature is mute, and you and I are just simply using words to manipulate each other. That's it. So communication breaks down. We end up in these little self-contained, kind of hermetically sealed things, monads, to use Leibniz's term, who don't actually connect with each other at all. We're ultimately entirely alone. Now you know why people are getting so weird. Popular result is normophobia. I'd like to read the one of the paragraphs from this article, Normophobia, to give you kind of a taste for what she's getting at. She says, normophobia frames everything. Conventional, average, given, assumed, traditional, and normative, whether it is its origin be physiological or cultural, as arbitrary and coercively constructed to support vested interests, particularly those of white Christian heterosexual men. Radical normophobes describe their aim explicitly as the total eradication of this, they claim, artificially naturalized domain of the natural, in quotes, in favor of untrammeled, free-floating individual desire. Desire, that's all we've got. You want to be a little furry? Who am I to say that's not a good idea? Go for it. Now, this is the real origin of keep it weird. And that's why it's so weird in places like Portland and Austin and so forth. And why, you know, the city across the Columbia has a saying, keep it normal. Did you know that the saying of Vancouver is keep it normal? But anyway, maybe we're being colonized by people over here. They're just coming over in droves to that side of the river. So what we have is ideological capture. And that ideological capture is resistant to reality. And that's why when you bring up the facts of life or biology, it doesn't get you anywhere. It makes zero difference. Now, these people who live in their hermetically sealed fantasy lands are more and more miserable by the day. I'm not saying that there isn't a reality out there that you have to deal with. They just deny its significance and its moral authority. Completely. They're in their isolated little chambers, and the only comfort they have are the other miserable people who are in, you know, isolated chambers right next to them. They'll be weird together, I guess, or whatever. Now, what I want to reflect on for the rest of my talk is how to respond, and I want to start with how not to respond. So I'm going to start with, as the church, how do we not respond? So this... What I'm going to get at here is how to die in a blue state. Try to be as blue as possible and stay Christian. That is how to die. And, by the way, that's been the philosophy of the evangelical church for the last 30, 40 years. And the world has gotten weirder and weirder, and the church has gotten weirder and weirder, just a little bit behind the weirdness of the larger culture. And one of the favorite verses that people like to point out to justify this whole approach is 1 Corinthians 9, chapter 9, verses 19 through 23. And this is where the Apostle Paul says, you know, when I'm with Jews, I'm like a Jew. When I'm with Gentiles, I'm like a Gentile. I'm all things to all men so that by all means I might save some. Now, my question is, did he have church growth pragmatism in mind when he said that? No. Now I want to give you another history lesson on Fuller Theological Seminary and the gift of the church growth movement to evangelicalism. So I know Andrew is a graduate of Fuller, and I feel for him. But anyway, so I want to talk about pragmatism first. Pragmatism is a form of liberalism. Basically, pragmatism is the conviction that we can't really know reality, that we just kind of have to blindly feel our way forward and experiment. And then when we face resistance, we can keep experimenting until we overcome the resistance. That's pragmatism. It's not a commitment. In other words, there's no commitment to objective reality in pragmatism. It's all about what works. And the Fuller Seminary guys back in the 70s and 80s decided that would be the way to go when it came to growing the church. And people like Donald McGavran, Peter Wagner, John Wimber, you know, seemed like every denomination had their sort of own version of those guys. And the reason it was because they did a really good job of reaching out to different denominations and co-opting the bureaucrats in those different denominations, particularly in the evangelism departments. So I knew some of these guys. I talked to them. I had an inside sort of view on some of that stuff. I was actually recruited to become the director of an institute in Los Angeles in the late 80s, early 90s. That would have put me on the faculty of Fuller Seminary. I turned it down because even then I could see things where things were going. But these guys, Donald McGavran, Peter Wagner, they were missiologists. In other words, they were people who studied the growth of Christianity in non-Western environments. That's really what they were about. Donald McGavran, if I remember correctly, did his missionary service in India. So what they did, what they thought they could do, or that their insight was, they could take sociology and apply the insights of sociology to help grow the church. In other words, it was an exercise in technique. If we employ certain techniques, we can encourage the growth of Christianity in these different places. Maybe they weren't terribly reflective when it came to the theological implications of this. And it doesn't seem like they really gave much thought to the fact that the church had done pretty well for 18 centuries without the church growth movement. But that's where this all came from. Now, the theory is that it would be possible to isolate the kerygma. The kerygma is sort of the gospel nut from the husk or the shell that is the cultural casing. And this is not a bad way of thinking. I mean, it makes tons of sense in a lot of ways. There are things about how church is done in Western society at different times that reflect the culture that, you know, Christianity finds itself in at any given time. So, once upon a time, people wore ties to church. I know it's hard to believe, but people did that crazy thing. And missionaries back in the 19th century, when they would evangelize and they would, you know, disciple people, they said, well, you got to start wearing ties because that's how you get dressed up for church. And so you have these people in different parts of the world dressing like Westerners to go to church. And, you know, I think it's a legitimate to say, you know, that's not necessarily part of the package when it comes to the Christian faith. We can separate certain cultural practices from the core message of the Christian faith, the gospel. So, what went wrong? Well, they took the insights of the movement and applied them to the United States and the Western world. And instead of focusing in on the culture at large, they focused in on subcultures. And there's an important difference between cultures and subcultures. I'd like to reflect with you a little bit on the nature of culture. The word culture has, again, a root. Cult. I don't know if you ever thought about it. Cult. Now, you might think of Jim Jones or the Moonies or Hare Krishnas, but cult just simply means worship. So we are cultists. Christians have a cult. And that cult is made up of certain practices, preaching, the sacraments, gathering on a particular day, that kind of stuff, singing, psalms. Those are things that are that constitute the liturgy or the work of the people in the cult. Now, the word cult also provides the root for cultivation. That's an interesting thing, isn't it, that you have worship and cultivation and a common root word that informs both. And then you have the word culture. So, to kind of give you a sort of a 30,000 foot, very, you know, sort of undefined overview, the cult is the basis for the cultivation of the world and the cultivation of people. That's always the way it works. At the center of every culture, there are values. And whether we call them, whether we call it catechesis or not, those values are communicated to the people in that culture, and they're expected to embody those values and go along with the general trajectory of the culture as it furthers its worship. What we have with a subculture, though, is we move from an intergenerational project. Culture is an intergenerational project. In other words, we have generations and there's a structure and there are traditions and ways of doing things and doctrines that are handed down from one generation to another. And that is the way people are cultivated and become cultured in that particular environment. So there's always an intergenerational component to a culture. One way you can distinguish a subculture from a culture is a subculture doesn't necessarily have that. A subculture can simply be something that is focused on the tastes of a particular group of people, or maybe the interests of a particular group of people. Let's say we have the subculture of rail, you know, sort of model railroading. And I'm going to start the Model Railroading Church for Christ. And we're going to reach every model railroader in America for Jesus. This is where you get things, you know, kind of get kind of goofy. Now, I use that absurd illustration to say that we have that kind of thing going on in a lot of churches that are trying to reach blue states. We want to become as blue as possible and still be Christian. And this is like a doorway. This is like a gateway drug to apostasy. I've seen it again and again. This is not actually reaching anybody. In fact, the work of conversion seems to be working in the other direction in many of the instances that I'm aware of. And what you end up with is contextualization transitions into marketing. I've actually read church growth books that actually put it that baldly. Marketing your church. Problem, of course, is that, you know, somebody can come along with a better marketing scheme. It's sort of like Sears going out of business because Amazon's now on the scene. And the church goes from being the thing that's at the very center of our lives to a consumer product. We think about church in that way because we tend to treat it as a consumer product. And what we want to do now is we want to provide the kind of consumer product that would appeal to people who live in blue states. We want to get as blue as possible. Let me give you an example of how this works. I've been to Tim Keller's church maybe 3-4 times. It's like a youth group for people in their 30s. There are no kids. Why? Because kids get in the way of all kinds of important things like your career. And living in a cool place like New York. Have you ever been to Manhattan? Does it strike you as a family-friendly environment? It's a really an odd place. And I think we need to have the church there, but I think it ought to function more like a rescue mission. You know, we used to have rescue missions in cities. I actually worked in a rescue mission in Kansas City. And, you know, the rescue mission was intended to save people who were down and outers, people who were on the street, on drugs, that kind of thing. We'd bring them in, give them a shower, give them food, they had to pay by listening to his sermon. I preached that sermon many times. What we need is a ministry to up-and-outers. These are people who are just as messed up as those folks who are down-and-outers. The difference, of course, is the connections and the money. And they can afford to live insane lives for a whole lot longer. I remember I had a friend. His name was Roger Dewey. Roger was the head of Christians for Urban Justice in Boston. I was involved in urban ministry for a number of years. I got all kinds of crazy stories. I was mugged. I was in a gang fight. I got all kinds of fun stuff. I could kind of keep you entertained for hours with all of my crazy stories. Roger was the head of this organization, Christians for Urban Justice. He was involved with business development in poor neighborhoods. And then suddenly he just disappeared. And then he reappeared. And I connected with him. And he was now a chaplain at prep schools for super elite kids. I'm talking about the blue people. The blue people in New England. And I said, Roger, what happened? You know, how did you go from that setting to this setting? He said, you know, Chris, it's just not that much different. Dad's never home. Drugs everywhere. People messed up. Sexual insanity. Difference is the money. And the connections. The connections. So what I want to think about at this point is liberalism even a culture? Is culture compatible with liberalism? Or is it more of like a cancer? Is it kind of an anti-culture that's eating the vitals of our civilization? I think that's more the case. It's hostile to duty. It's hostile to roles. It's hostile to self-denial. It's hostile to the very notion that you can order your life. It's hostile to all these things. Let me give you an example of how to think about this. In antiquity, a person would be understood, if you did a taxonomy on a human being, you would say there is reason, there are the virtues, and then there are appetites. Right? Head, chest, stomach. A sick person has their stomach where their head should be. That's a sick person. Or someone whose affections are out of order, who thinks that it's their emotions that dictate behavior, and that should be the thing that gives them their sense of self. I need to be authentic. Well, you know what? Your authenticity is killing you. Get over it. You need to get your life in order, and the way that occurs is to conform to the wisdom of God. Conform the way you think, the way you feel. You can do that. Have you ever said to yourself, this is a really stupid way of feeling right now? If you've never said that, you need to learn to say it. Because a lot of the time that's the case. Your feelings are not trustworthy. You should discipline them. You're in charge, not those things. I remember I was listening to a psychologist, and he was talking about somebody, you know, obviously, who was, you know, on the couch talking. And she was talking about how to control her life was, you know, sexually, drugs, all this kind of stuff. And he said to her, stop it. Just stop it. And it was like a revelation. And she said, you mean I don't have to do the things I want to do? And he said, right. You don't. There are standards that can be applied. And those standards are good for you. So liberalism is hostile to natural law. When I talk about values and what, you know, Psalm 19 is talking about, but also the facts of nature. Liberalism is hostile to the very facts of nature. How else do we explain this transgenderism insanity? It's hostile to the very facts of nature. So when it comes to contextualization and subcultures and political environments that are just sick and getting worse by the day, we should not contextualize to those. I have a friend back in Boston, his name is Ray Hammond, really brilliant guy, went to Harvard when he was 16 years old, got his MD, and then he planted a church. So this guy was a medical doctor and a pastor planted a church. He still was a medical doctor even though he was planting the church. And I said to him, Ray, what do you think about contextualizing to the inner city? And he looked at me like I had two heads. He said, why should I contextualize to death? Don't try to be blue. Don't try to get as close to stupid as you can get. What we need is cultural Christianity. Now, that I'm going to talk about something that's kind of weird, because people are used to thinking of cultural Christianity as like a bad thing. But there are lots of reasons why we think that way, and I'm going to get into those things in a minute here. But there's a classic work, Richard Niebuhr's Christ and Culture. Anybody familiar with that book? It's horrible. Absolutely. The premise is the wrong starting place. Basically, Christ and Culture, basically five ways of communicating Christian ethics and the presuppositions that lie behind those different approaches. But Christianity is not just ethics. It's a way of life. I am the way, the truth, and the life. It's a culture. It's a culture. And what we need to do is live it out in blue places. And it's not red, it's not purple, it's just Christianity. That's what we need to live out in these places. Now, one of the problems that we face, apart from Niebuhr's Christ and Culture, is there are ways of misunderstanding the relationship between creation and the new creation. And I'd like to talk about those, two of them. We've already talked about one of them, but let me begin with pietism. Now, I wrote a book on piety entitled The Household and War for the Cosmos, but it's the old-fashioned kind of piety. I'm talking really old-fashioned. I'm talking like first century old-fashioned. It has nothing to do with pietism as we think about it today. Pietism is the heart religion. You know, Jesus in your heart, and that's where it stops. It's internal, it's personal, and it's anti-institutional. It's withdrawing. It withdraws from the world because the world is messy and difficult and disappointing and sin, full of sin. This approach to understanding the Christian life as this internal project, this project that just takes place solely within yourself. And there are lots of wonderful things about it. I'm all for, you know, having a great prayer life. I'm all for, you know, reading scripture. I'm all for your daily disciplines and all that kind of stuff. But the salvation that we are promised in Christ is much more comprehensive than the interiority of your body or the interiority of your life. It includes everything. Everything. The very creation groans, awaiting the revelation of the sons of God. In other words, the bondage to decay that the very creation is subject to, it will be delivered from because of the work of Christ. We're waiting for that. It hasn't, you know, it hasn't fully come about yet. But in the creeds, we're told that, it will. And the creeds, of course, are summaries of Scripture. The other is dispensationalism. And dispensationalism might be summed up as, this world is not my home, but it also could be summed up as, this world has no future. Remember late, great planet Earth? Just, you know, 70s. Again, I'm a child of the 70s. What's on the cover? The Earth. You remember that? You know, there's this sort of apocalyptic fever, and apocalypse was associated with destruction. Just everything goes. Consequently, it's hard to think long term if you don't think anything's going to be around much longer. So let me just finish with a few thoughts or tips for how to practice cultural Christianity. One is it's pro-dominion. Christ is Lord. Christ is Lord of Portland. I know it's awfully hard to imagine, but he is. It's Portland's as much subject to the lordship of Christ as Moscow, Idaho, Moscow, or whatever other place you imagine is you know, the place that you want to be. And it's pro-natal. In other words, we believe that children are wonderful and we need more of them, which makes us really weird in a world where birth rates are plummeting and we're on the precipice of like an irreversible slide. You know, the numbers, you can do the numbers. There are lots of people who are talking about it. Even Elon Musk is talking about it. Korea, I think it's 0.7 children per woman now. In Seoul, it's like, I think it's 0.59 children per woman. Guess what? Korean businesses are intentionally relocating now, anticipating they will not be able to fill the slots they need to fill. So they're moving out of Korea. And we see it in Japan, we see it in China, we see it in Italy. You want a nice rural Italian home, you can get it for a buck. They are so desperate over there because the countryside is just empty. There are places now, I believe they closed 150 schools in Korea because there were zero children in the first grade in those schools. And we're moving in that direction in our own country. So we win just simply by multiplying. We inherit the earth just by showing up. So the other thing that related to this is we need to make sure our households are productive. We need to be pro-property. One of the ways we exercise dominion is by actually owning stuff, businesses, et cetera. And then I think we also need to be unapologetically different. Unapologetically different. That's the best apologetic. It's when people finally wake up and realize, I have believed the most unbelievable, stupid stuff for years, and I'm tired of being dumb. And they look around and say, who's not dumb? We want to be able to say, here we are. We do stuff that works. This is where reality is, you know, seen as a marvelous thing and not a source of oppression. We need to spend time studying the blindness and weaknesses and the weakness of liberalism, and we need to sow seeds of doubt in people's lives. Sometimes when people believe the wrong stuff, they got to stop believing it before they can start believing the right stuff. So we need to plant seeds of doubt. Doesn't mean that every conversation ends the way we'd like it to end or where we'd like it to end, but at least we can give them something to think about. And then I think we need to be easy to spot. Lifeguards are easy to spot. That's what we need to be. We need to stand out and be easy to spot so that when people are looking for help and looking to escape the culture of death that they find themselves in, they can identify us as a place that they're going to be introduced to life. So let me just finish with two final thoughts. And these have to do with not making sure you don't get fooled. The thing that always remember about elites is they live double lives. They are not honest. There's a marvelous book by Rob Henderson entitled Troubled. It's about a guy who, as a child, went into foster care and spent his entire childhood in foster care because his mother was a drug addict and his father had deserted the family. And just a terrible story, but ends well. He ends up going to Yale, and then after that to Cambridge, and now he's got his PhD. And while he was at Yale and Cambridge, he looked around at all these, you know, one percenters, and he saw that they said one thing and did something different. They had luxury beliefs, stuff that they would say, but they didn't actually do. The one percenters own property. They're really not into communism. I just want you to know. And it's held in families for generations. In other words, they believe and practice productive household management for generations. They're intergenerational. They think a lot about who their kids are going to marry. They think about the education of those kids, make sure that they have the right connections. In other words, what they say is intended to not necessarily reveal who they are. It's intended to make an impression. I'm cool. I'm hip. I'm in the know. But they don't actually live that way. They are hypocrites. I've got many of them in my family, and so does my wife. We come from blue people. We're from the blue meanies, and so we can tell you all about, and you probably have some too, that insanity. But it's like a Gucci purse. Saying that you support, you know, gay marriage is like a Gucci purse. You don't actually marry, you know, someone of your own sex, but you say it's a good thing. And then you get invited to the party. That's it. They don't live that way. Then the other thing is, don't be overly impressed with social capital. Don't be overly impressed with the institutions that communicate social standing and are the kind of the hallmarks of the elite, because they're being squandered by the day. It was amazing to see what happened at Harvard with the president there. So I get emails from Harvard almost every week, kind of giving me the inside perspective on how they view things. But you know, you remember Claudine Gay, right? You know, she was accused of plagiarism, and it's pretty obvious. She was a really mediocre scholar. Her two qualifications were being black and woman. You know, basically that's how she got the job. But they did everything in their power to cover for her, but even Harvard couldn't manage it. And now they've taken a hit. The prestige took a big hit because the prestige is based on an image that they project. And to be taken to the woodshed like they were taken in the public square hurt them bad. People are applying to other schools. So their applications went down quite a bit this year. And they even brought back standardized testing. They knew they had to do something to get people believing in them again. So these things can fall apart fast. Don't be overly impressed with this stuff. We're building tomorrow's world today. Once upon a time, Harvard, you know what Harvard is, who Harvard is named for? A guy named Harvard, of course. And how did the school get named for him? He donated his library. He was a pastor. You go to Harvard Square, there's a statue of John Harvard. I think it's still there. I don't think they toppled it. But anyway, it was a little kind of, it was a lot smaller than New St. Andrews when it got its start. Now, today, it's enormous, of course, with the world's largest endowment. I think $50 billion endowment. But it had a small beginning. Don't despise the day of small things. Don't despise the day of small things. Where is the Babylonian Empire? Go over there and it's just desert. Lord, taking the long view, being patient, we're a part of a project, a culture-building project, that looks to the future and is intergenerational in character. This is one of the reasons why I'm a Presbyterian. I believe in covenant theology, because covenant theology is about this intergenerational feature to life and reality. Anyway, enough of that. Thanks a lot.